the National Archives podcast series, Cataloguing Projects During 2016, Changing the Landscape, the Enclosure Map Project, presented by Emma Down and Matt Hilliard.
Thanks very much. Myself and Matt are going to be talking about the Enclosure Map Project. And just to give you an overview of our presentation, I'm going to talk a little bit about the process of enclosure to begin with, and then explain the background to this project. Matt is then going to talk a little bit about how we process the data, and then I'm going to come back and tell you a bit about the research uses that you can use these records for. So what was enclosure? The process of enclosure and the records that are created by it can be quite complex. And we hope that this project will actually make research in this area much easier. So enclosure has been taking place in various forms since the Middle Ages, although the majority of enclosure took place between the 18th and 19th centuries. In earlier times, enclosure was simply the physical sectioning off of a piece of land with either a fence or a hedge or something similar. And this land could be reclaimed, for example, from like a woodland or forest. But as time went on, more formal procedures put in place, and the documents which I'm going to talk about today relate to this later stage of enclosure. So this was primarily parliamentary enclosure, and this stemmed from a private act of parliament or from one of the General Enclosure Acts, which had been passed since 1836. Or this could be an agreement in a written form, which was then signed by all the parties involved. So why did this type of formal closure, start to happen? Well, the main reason was to farm more efficiently. So this then could increase productivity and therefore economic income. Local landowners wanted to consolidate their landholding into larger privately farmed fields on which they could use new agricultural machinery. The documents which illustrate this process come in two parts. We have the awards and the maps. So the award is the legal text document, which is usually written on parchment. Maps didn't really become commonplace until the latter half of the 18th century, as although mapping added to the cost of the process, they were also helpful in visually expressing the plots which were owned by each party. Enclosure maps exist for around 24% of England and Wales, but the amount of land enclosed is likely to be much more, as maps were not created for every enclosure. The enclosure maps within TNA's holdings predominantly date from the 19th century, and many of these stem from the Enclosure Acts, which were issued between 1845 and 1899. And these can be found in record series MAF 1. Other enclosure maps were distributed throughout the collections as they were enrolled in the records of Chancery, the Court of Common Pleas, the Exchequer, and the King's Bench. Often these maps have been separated from the relevant award for preservation reasons, but this will always be noted in the catalogue, so you can find the relevant award to the map. It's also really important to note that TNA does not hold all extant enclosure records. So many are still held at local record offices, and these could be copies which were deposited with the Clerk of the Peace, and these are now known as the county enrolled copies. The parish copy or a landlord's copy could also be held at a local record office. So it's worth bearing in mind that a single enclosure may actually have a number of different maps or copies across across England and Wales. So a bit more about the background to the project. Many of you might be aware of the Tithe project, which was completed in 2013. This project is similar, but on a much smaller scale. So the project that I've been working on consists of around 1,500 pieces. As with the Tithe project, we were gifted data from Professor Roger Kane, John Chapman, and Dr. Richard Oliver from a study that they had done at the University of Exeter in the 1990s on the enclosure maps of England and Wales. So their study produced this book, which is the enclosure maps of England and Wales, and this explains the enclosure process in much more detail. So if you're really interested in enclosure, this is the book to look at. They also give in their book an analysis of enclosure within each county, and they also contains an index of places which have extant enclosure maps. This index is also available in an online database, It gives details of the enclosure maps and where they're held. And the project was also really useful as it highlighted a handful of maps which hadn't been previously listed in Edward Tate's A Doomsday of English Enclosure Acts and Awards, which had previously been the standard reference work on the subject. Okay, so to give you an idea of the online database, this is the description for MAF 1, piece 715. And this is the enclosure map for Swannington in Norfolk. This map is actually made up of two parts, and this is the entry for map B, and there's a separate entry for map A. You can see that you get details such as the date, the place, where the document's held, which is quite important, the valuer, physical attributes of the map, such as its size and what it's made from, as well as details which are shown on the map. So you could get information about woods, lakes, and so on that are shown. And this is the kind of extra information that we are adding to our discovery descriptions for the maps held at TNA. So the maps at TNA then, these are the actual documents. We've got map A on the left, which shows the land after enclosure, and map B on the right, which shows the land before enclosure. So one of the major outcomes from enclosure was an actual physical change in the landscape. So where once you had strip farming, which was commonplace, you now had large fields dominating the landscape. So if you look on map B on the sort of left-hand side, you can see there are lots of small plots of fields. But if you then compare this to map A, you'll see that the fields have become much larger. In addition, you could also get road layouts. They could be changed and altered, and this can also be sometimes seen in the documents. Unfortunately, not all enclosure maps have a before and after, such as this one, and many of them just show the land after the enclosure process. A less visible consequence of enclosure was the removal of communal rights over a piece of land and its conversion into sovereignty. So this was where the owner of the land had sole control over its use and access. Local people who used to have rights to graze their animals on these fields had their rights removed and were given land to pasture elsewhere, but often this land wouldn't be of as good quality. So as I mentioned before, Professor Kane, John Chapman and Dr. Oliver gifted us this data for the enclosure maps. But before we could go about incorporating this data into discovery, it had to be processed into a format that we could use and I could then edit. And this is what Matt's going to explain a little bit more about now.
Okay, thanks, Emma. So you've seen what the maps look like and you saw the amount of detail in the Exeter database about these maps, or about one of them in particular. Let's have a look to see how much detail we have currently in TNA's catalogue. The answer is not a lot. It's the barest minimum description. As you can see, a reference, a date, and the description of the place involved. But there are no details at all. So if you're interested in ordering this map, you know, it'd be nice to know up front, you know, what exactly does it cover. Are there any buildings listed on there? Are there people's names, you know, plot owners and so on? There's no detail, effectively. Then that, you can imagine if somebody wanted to order a remote copy of this at some expense, they may be disappointed if, in fact, the map was very plain and had the barest minimum detail on it. And there, just for emphasis, there we see, once again, the same map in the Exeter database. Compare and contrast, I think, speaks for itself. So then I had to, then we were, as Emma said, we were gifted this data, and this data was compiled in the 1990s. Let's have a look what it looked like when I was actually given the raw bones. So at first glance, it looks the same, or certainly very similar. You've got this kind of tabular format. But if I go back to the original, to the online version of the Exeter application, you see on the left, we've actually got proper field names. I mean, database field names. Let's not confuse that with physical fields. But so that, you know, they're actually saying meaningful things. So this is a year, category, place, county, and so on. We look at the raw data. No such luck. We've got numbers effectively, and some kind of three-letter code. And this is actually just a subset of the total amount. So you see at the very bottom there, we've got field 140. So for every single map, in the database, there were potentially 140 fields of detail. So we've got a problem. First of all, we've got strange looking field names, and how do we marry those things together? If we look back again, you see that towards the bottom of this listing, you know, you've got proper detail on the right there. But if you look at it in the database format, it seems to be quite strange. They're just codes, they're just letters, and it doesn't seem to bear any, or there's certainly a difference between what you see on the online version and what's actually in the database. So, and this is particularly apparent if you look at, so about two-thirds of the way down, there's a description there. Status of map, official copy of map made under the General Enclosure Act 1845 for the Enclosure Commission. The equivalent in the database is field 034 STT code PE. So obviously we needed to do something about that. So the authors then kindly produced, given us the raw data, then kindly also gave us a 21-page Word document, which was effectively a glossary describing what all these different fields were and what all the different codes were. So then I had to take that and start building a program around that. But that wasn't enough, because then the experts in the map team needed to also vet that glossary, because there may have been conventions in the data description which wouldn't fit in with our catalogue now, and you know, there may be fields that are just too detailed for us, and we just don't have a place for them in the catalogue. So that was another 31 pages of instructions to what to do with the data once you've translated it. So all of which was a bit daunting at first, but so then it was a case of turning it into something which would be compatible with Discovery. And that means both in terms of the format, so electronically, digitally, if you like, for our database, but also in a way that would meet our cataloguing guidelines. And above all, is readable and understandable and is useful to people doing research. So all of that led to rules for conversion. And this is where it gets interesting, perhaps. So rule one, and perhaps some of you are already thinking, I hope rule one is you do not talk about data conversion. I'm afraid I'm going to. But the first one is nice and easy. Ignore it. So we had that field, the very first field in the database, RCD stands for recorded. That was the date that one of the authors actually visited a record office and examined the map. But not relevant to us, wouldn't be relevant to the Discovery description. Let's move on. Rule two. Okay, interpret code. So we saw that there were some strange-looking letters in the raw data. Field 30, there's a code B there. So what did that mean? Well, that means that it shows the land before enclosure. As Emma said, you have map B and map A, one showing before and one showing after. This was the one showing before. There's another example, field 59, to do with churches this time. This time we've got a P. What does a P mean? So just if you were in any doubt, here's a little tiny extract from the author's original glossary. And it gives you an indication of the amount of detail they went into and why their book here is you know, the most comprehensive it could possibly be, but right down to the level of, you know, what kind of, well, this is code PP, says here, a pictogram or a symbol, but they went to the detail of, you know, does it have a cross on it, is there a spire, is it a tower, are there graveyards? Again, just not really the kind of level of detail that we need for the catalogue description. We just need to know, in fact, that there's a church there. I mean, that's enough for us. And likewise, even that extra bit of note there, you know, the fact that it's a bit tumbled down and the tower has recessed stages, it's just too much detail for Discovery. Rule three, expand on a yes-no. So some of those fields, you may have noticed, they just had Y or N against them. not a code as such, just does this thing exist or not? So field 72, that was a lake, so okay, lakes or ponds is what we'll put in the description. Field 93, another yes. Again, this time with a little bit of note added, but you know, we're just going to ignore that. It's too much information. What it does relate to is the fact that it's uncultivated ground, and that's what's important for our description. Rule 4, okay, take the data, but do something with it. So there we are, field 13, that's the National Grid reference, the British Ordnance Survey grid reference. Our convention in the catalogue would be to spell that out or space it out for readability. So I would have to take that value there, just clean it up slightly. Not too difficult. Likewise, field 16, the sum, what is that? We've got a figure there, and it's even with decimal places. But what that's about is the size, the coverage of the map. It actually means acres. We're not really concerned about the decimal places, so you know, we would round that up or round that down. Dimensions of the map. You think, oh, well, that's straightforward, isn't it? But first of all, it doesn't tell us what those dimensions are. Like, are they millimetres? Hopefully not. Centimetres, obviously. But the author's convention was to do width before height. The convention in our catalogue is the other way around. So then I would have to take those two values, flip them over, add a degree of measure to go with them. Sorry, it goes on. Rule 5, expand an abbreviation. So county, the field 3, there's an easy one, NFK for Norfolk. Let's have a look at another one. We've got an RO there, okay, nice and easy again. That just means record office. That's not too difficult. Let's have another version of that same field from a different map. RO again, oh yeah, well, am I going to translate that to record office? Well, actually, in the 1990s when this database was compiled, it was Bedfordshire Record Office. Now it's Bedfordshire and Luton Archives. So that was something else I would then have to do. I'd have to look up in one of our own databases to see what the modern or the up-to-date version of the name of the repository is. And sometimes it gets even worse. Here, RO doesn't stand for Record Office, and Middlesex doesn't even stand for Middlesex. So you can see the benefits of doing that. Next rule, okay, we'll use the data, what we've got, we do want it, but it's not in the form that we would want. So our convention there you see on the right is 2nd of Jan 1850. And that's, as you can, I mean, the version that the format they used in their database is perfectly valid, but for an American reader, they may misinterpret that. So they may read that as the 1st of February, not the 2nd of January. Hence the way we do it. Again, something I had to convert. Back to grid references. So mentioned this one before, talked about spacing this for the National Grid Reference version, but obviously with modern applications now, I mean, that's a very British-centric thing anyway, so it's fine within this country, but if you want to be international and you want to look to find out where this location, the location of this map is on Google Maps, for example, you would need that in latitude and longitude, so which is something else I had to do, and that was an incredibly complex algorithm, but I didn't write that, I just incorporated that, fortunately. That's something that's been written by somebody previously. So we've just got one more to go. Now this one is perhaps the trickiest rule of all. Use it just as it comes. Phew. And there we go. There's one. Valuer, field 15. Robert Wright of Norwich, land surveyor. That's perfect. We don't need to do anything with it. We just take it as it is, pop it in the data in our version of the description. So, all of that, there's a little formula of a kind. 140 fields, 7 different strategies, if you like, 7 rules. Put that together with the 21-page glossary from the authors and the 31 pages of instructions from the map team. And I ended up writing a program which was 6,000 lines long. So it kept me busy for a while, let's see. And was it worth it? Well, here we go. Here's what the description would then look like for that I would pass across to Emma. So this is an encoded archival description, EAD, International Standard for Archival Description. It's an XML format, and you can see, you know, already it's beginning to approach something that resembles how you would recognise these descriptions in Discovery. Things in their right places, the, you know, the dates, the top, the reference, and so on, some dimensions, as I mentioned before. And the main crux of it in the middle there, the description field. And you'll notice also what I've on top of everything else, then I would, having translated everything into a meaningful version of description for our purposes, I also then have to knit it all together in a readable way. So I couldn't just, you know, list all these bits of information. I had to kind of flow and read properly. So, for example, so the second sentence there, map covers the enclosed area and some other land, brackets 800 acres, and shows the land before enclosure. Also shows lakes or ponds, woods, uncultivated ground, open field strips, footpaths or bridleways, school, church, named buildings, parish boundaries, some named landowners. Scale, 1 inch to 3 chains by Robert Wright, and so on. So, you know, it's human readable. It's gone from being that tabular kind of top trump card version of the data that you saw earlier to something that you is more recognisable. So this is for map B. Then so there's an equivalent version for map A. Looks very similar. Because we only have the one reference, however, for both these maps, you know, if you were to order these, they would come as a pair. So we only have the single description in the catalogue. So then this is where Emma's eagle editorial eye was brought to bear, and she had to then combine these two descriptions, leaving us with effectively the finished product prior to load to the database. And so there we go. And if you're in any doubt as to was it all worth it, were those 6,000 lines of code, etc., all worth it, well, I think it was definitely worthwhile.
Okay, thanks, Matt. I'm just going to take you through another example now, just to highlight a couple other things that we've done with the editing. So this is an example of an enclosure map for Liss in Hampshire. In Math 1, and as we had with the other map, you've literally got just kind of the place and the date. And this is what it has become. So now you can see we've got a lot more information. So we know it's a map, this time consisting of 7 sheets. And we know that it shows the enclosed area only, so not the whole parish. We also know it shows the land after enclosure. This is an example where we don't have any information about what the land looked like beforehand. Importantly, and what I want to draw your attention to, is that we've also added the reference for the award. So you can see that this is number piece 768, which is the map. And down at the bottom, you can see the award is actually at piece number 1008. So often the award will not be anywhere near the piece number for the map. So that's a really important way of trying to match those up. And we've also put in information about the location of the county or parish copies of this map, where we know it. So in this case, the county copy of the map is held at Hampshire Archives, and you've got the reference there. But please be aware that not every description has information about other copies, but that does not necessarily mean that those copies don't exist. It just means that we don't have that information. It's also important to note that not every archive will have an online description, so you may not be able to search these references online as well. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the research uses of these maps. So I've got a case study here from East Burgholt, which is in Suffolk. And this map was made by Robert Corby in 1817, and it's quite interesting for a number of reasons. It is also one of our most detailed and colourful maps. Often they're not always as interesting as this. It shows the land after enclosure, and it also gives pictorial images of prominent buildings. So in the top image, you can see the church there in one of the enlargements. And it also gives you the street names, which aren't always, there's not often enough room on a map to include these. So you can also see Burnt Oak Street there. As well as information about the various landholders, you've also got details of public roads. You'll see that you have the first public road and the second public road are highlighted, and this is all across the map. And this can be really useful if you're researching public rights of way kind of information. So another interesting fact about this map is that it's got lots of the landholders written on the map itself. So if we study the landholders, we see a famous face appear. And at the bottom of the screen here, we've got John Constable. And just above him, we have his younger brother, Abraham Constable, who was a farmer in the area. And under Abraham's description, you've got details of people who he purchased land off, including we've got Henry Cook at the top there, but also his own brother at the bottom, purchased land off John Constable. And it also tells you if the land was freehold or copyhold, which can be a useful thing to have. Now, if we go back to the main map, you'll see that you have some landmarks here which feature in Constable's paintings. Now, back in 2010, some research was conducted into the places that were painted by Constable and trying to locate these actual areas. So I've just got a couple to show you now. The first one you'll see at the top of the screen, we've got an image of the map, which quite clearly shows the windmill in the middle there. And then below that, we've got the image that Constable painted. The windmill is actually on land, which was farmed by Abraham Constable. And I wonder if the little figure ploughing in the image there could even be Abraham himself. So the next one then is Flatford Mill, another place that's clearly labelled on the map. And Constable painted this view of Flatford Mill. Really importantly, he painted it in the same year that the map was created. So these are both, you know, are contemporary images. And I think it's really interesting to compare these two depictions of the same area, which are off, you know, quite different, but you can kind of imagine imagine that scene on the map itself. Now, it wouldn't be right to mention Constable without talking about the Hay Wain. The Hay Wain was painted just after the map, so in 1821. And William Lott, whose cottage features in the painting, also features as an allottee on the map itself. So in the top there, we can see that he comes out and his plot number is number 126. Now, plots of land could be distributed quite widely. They were not necessarily next to your dwelling or your house. So William's plot was actually up near the windmill up here. And if I show you the main map again, you can see, so Flatford Mill is down at the bottom where his cottage is, and his plot was actually, you know, quite a way away up at the top. So he would have had quite a trudge to get to his the land that he was farming there. Okay, so to conclude then, just some details about the project progress. So the MAF1 descriptions are currently being checked, and we hope that these will be updated into Discovery sometime after Christmas. The descriptions relating to the enrolled enclosures in the other series are currently being enhanced, and we hope that those will be available sometime in the spring of next year.
Thanks very much.
This talk was recorded on the 25th of November 2016 at the National Archives, Kew.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, all rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government Licence.